Conference record has joined the conference.
But it is significant compared to.
Oh, yeah.
What's the amount of money I don't get compared to my other insurance?
Yes.
It's very simple.
Folks on the phone, can you hear us all right? Are you still muted out?
We've muted out the public, but supposedly sent a line in for our members. We mainly have one name to be able to call in. So.
Okay, so the goal for the rest of the afternoon with a hard stop time of around 3 p.m. is to get through as much of the list as we can. We don't have to finish, we will never finish the full list. I think we had an idea in our head that if we could get through about 5 to 10 of them, that will be successful. Let's keep our comments as we have throughout this meeting, short to the point, not redundant, adding value and thinking broadly in terms of principles and process for the future, as well as a specific proposal in front of us. We'll start with the second one down the list, limit coverage of arthroscopic knee surgery for osteoarthritis. Foster some background.
I think this one, and Mark, maybe you can help us out, came from a list of suggestions from OHSU. And I can't recite chapter and verse the level of the evidence on this. Mark may be able to do that, but clearly there have been studies recently which have shown very limited to zero impact for arthroscopic surgery for this specific indication. What I don't know is how big, I don't know how big an issue this is in terms of our spend. And there are issues that this might raise in terms of our ability to specifically limit based on diagnosis in terms of that systems fix. But Mark, you want to make a comment about that evidence part?
Very briefly, there has been one randomized controlled trial that included sham surgery for arthroscopy in this case, for osteoarthritis, and it was shown to be no beneficial effect to through that one RCT. The only complicating piece when you're thinking about this particular coverage issue has to do with osteoarthritis of the knee without mechanical disruption. So if you've got a torn meniscus, then that's not included. It's just basically if you've got bone-on-bone osteoarthritis, the lodging agreement is not going to do you any good. So it's fairly narrow. And to your point, Foster, I'm not sure what the fiscal impact would be, but they really I guess the other thing is, while it's not been shown to be beneficial, there are, even for arthroscopy, as minimally invasive as that is for an orthopedic procedure, there are complications that take place from surgery as well.
The point of clarity is to steer away from any other, it's very clear here, but to steer away from possibility of congestion, hyaluronic acid injections, et cetera.
There's another one around spine. There's not another one that's specific just on this therapy.
Under explanation, I fear that this explanation understates the case. So it states here that there is no evidence of improvement in pain or function, but there actually is evidence that there's no improvement in pain and function. And that's a much, much, much stronger statement. And I would advocate that when that is the case, in other words, when something has been studied well via experimental evidence, and there's evidence of no improvement, that we should say that explicitly because it's immeasurably stronger than the explanation here.
Good point. And I think we can fill in some of the level of evidence column as well from Dr. Vincent's work.
Which sounds like, based on what you said, it's probably using our typology type 2 in that it was a one randomized, well-designed randomized controlled trial, just using one around that description of hierarchy of evidence.
I agree with the concept. The question will be, is will we have an unintended consequence of more MRIs to prove that there is meniscal injury in there? And will we also see more knee joint replacements because we're now moving in that direction? Just in terms of when you look at your back end, look at this process of changing this recommendation.
Maybe we should check and see what the guidelines are for knee replacement and make sure that those are the criteria we adhere to if they do exist. That's one of the follow-ups before we go ahead with this.
And I guess when you do the financial analysis, to also look at it for what's being spent here versus what's being spent on knee surgery so that you kind of like are able to balance.
Junior point, I think, raises illuminates that for some of these, it's not that hard to think about what the potential unintended consequences might be. If it can't be planned for or prevented, to at least know what kinds of things to look at over, post any kind of discovery.
Is there a way to try to offset these unintended consequences? But, I can't think of a patient of mine who, when I examine the knee and they got OA. And what the hell are we doing an MRI? And so is there a way that we could limit that, including that, to try to augment and prevent some of that?
Well, we're going to push them for that first medicine.
Yeah, right.
Obesity treatment.
Because what I see often is that they'll have the arthroscopic knee done, and then 6 months later they have their knee replaced.
I think that's...
And that's common.
It doesn't work. So basically what you're doing is an ineffective procedure before you go to
the effect
something else. And so, you can at least take that one out. You may be ahead of the game.
This is special.
One to pursue? I don't hear anything that says we shouldn't pursue this one, right?
Yeah, it should be in the health one, too. Got covered.
Put all the easy ones first. Just get you warm.
Yeah, right.
Warmed up. So the next one around specific treatments for back pain. Again, I think, Mark, this is in your list. There is, the level of evidence around this, but there's certainly for some of these specific procedures, there's been recent, I think, good evidence around lack of efficacy.
Actually, there is in this set of interventions as well, to Scott's point.
there is evidence that they don't work.
Absolutely.
So,
can I just ask a question? And is the efficacy in terms of relief of pain or treatment of an underlying condition?
Actually, the relief of pain functions well, as I recall. I agree with the explanations. We have to be very explicit about making sure that we word it appropriately and say there is evidence that does not benefit or there is no evidence. So wherever that is the case, we'll fill that up, and we'll also put in the level of evidence for any that we are going forward. If there is any evidence, we'll fill those in as well.
Could I ask a question about what does administrative action mean?
Usually it means we don't need to change the law.
So, just do it.
Right. No state plan amendments. Basically, they just say, sorry.
No longer in the...
And then you have to
be trying
to do whatever.
So if you're a patient with low back pain, what's the alternative treatment for this?
Let's wait.
Strengthening
your core muscles. I mean, low back pain never gets better. It just doesn't. And so it really becomes a clinically an issue of that you have to figure out how you're going to accommodate to it. You can put shots in as much as you want, and it's just not going to fix the problem.
Acupuncture.
So is acupuncture one of the things?
There's some evidence for acupuncture in some cases.
Is it covered?
$6.8 million.
But that would be that. That's another proposal.
$6.8 million savings just feels much too small. Is this statewide?
Too small?
Yeah. I would assume that back pain being so common that these are used much more frequently if you look at all of the managed care claims. Is this statewide or is it fee-for-service claims?
Ron, let me ask you this. Did we include the systemic corticosteroids in here, or just the procedures in that count, in that dollar figure? Yeah. So this right now is a procedure count, and that's the count of claims we have for fee-for-service and managed care, and spend for both, or just the fee-for-service? Spend for both.
Not including the MRI.
What's that?
Not including all the MRI.
Probably not. But we're just looking at the procedures here.
Right. There's And what do you do with the dual? $1 million. For duals. So.
Yes, I think you have much greater potential.
We want to keep that under our hat for now. I'm just kidding. We'll as we progress these kinds of proposals, our assumptions will be clear. That we'll be more transparent about for those that we propose what is included in each of the numbers.
And you're not going to assume 20% either in or out. So it's going to be 100%. Reduction, was it?
Well, you know, to the extent that there are ways you can code things differently, there is some wiggle room. We assume that there will be some of that.
Usually the way we value savings in this instance is we'd add up everything we thought we could get with no leakage. And then we would add some leakage factor for, you know, the fact that something else would be provided. And if there's any evidence to inform those factors, we'll use them. If not, then we, you know, just use basic judgment on what that would look like.
These are defined. Can we put specific IUD codes that will impact? I think it's going to be nearly impossible to administer reduction of a specific benefit for a specific diagnosis. Unless we have a very clear and coding criteria of what they're expecting.
Yeah. We might need your help in the intervening time to try to do what we can on that issue and for you to raise, again, I think a point we shouldn't miss is the implementation of a lot of these things is going to fall into plans because that's where folks are enrolled. So if you, for any of these proposals, have implementation issues or details that you think are important for us to know.
I think the only issue is that there's opportunities for people to put this under the radar screen. For example, like the traction you get if you put a PT stuff or an office visit or a physical therapy, you can do the traction and then we know that that's what it's done. But you use E&M codes like for office visits and you do the injections or whatever. And I'm not sure like how we would then build toward the steroids or whatever, but creative ways of doing it. But so I hate to kind of go and temper Arnie's enthusiasm here, but the thing is, trying to find out the ones that are currently like doing like this, they might very well reverse to some versus billing.
And again, I mean,
presumed chronic discogenic low back pain, which results from positive results on proactive discography. There's consistent evidence from three trials, one higher quality, that intradiscal steroids are not associated with improved outcomes compared to control injections. The level of the evidence is good. They're actually doing a comparison injection with a placebo substance and comparing the results above.
Right. But Kathy, you're asking a good question, which is when we talk about improved outcomes, you know, being as precise or explicit or clear about that is important because there's obviously there's a mix of outcomes that people value to different degrees, right?
And I think you have to be very clear in the statement, treatment of low back pain. Are we talking about chronic low back pain, acute low back pain? What is our definition that we're defining on this statement here? Because there are different types of treatment.
And this evidence is around chronic.
I should say that right in the intro.
Yeah, and also speaking to that issue, we may not want to bundle them all together. So, for example, we may want to split off the lowest hanging fruit, which is the injections that have been shown to not be effective, at least as a starting point, because that's more of a slam dunk in terms of an action item.
You put enough Novocaine in somebody's back and they won't feel anything.
Yeah, but they often think they do, though.
Right.
Okay, let's move on. That was good discussion. Certified Lactation Council.
Let me just say, in terms of the level of evidence, it's not on here, but I think that lactation support in general is a U.S. Prevented Task Force recommended, I think it's a B item. Bob's nodding his head. That support does not specifically call out, I mean, this is a good example, I think, of the difference between a Prevented Task Force recommendation and designing a benefit. So the benefit, the recommendation from the task force talks about sort of organized support. It doesn't specifically say this kind of breath pump or this kind of personnel should provide the service at this sort of frequency. We have had, specific requests over the years around providing coverage payment for certified lactation counselors. And I guess the U.S. Preventive Task Force recommendation sort of add some oomph to, you know, that specific recommendation, although it doesn't specifically say that that's the way in which lactation support needs to be delivered.
Is there anything about where it's provided? Does this have to be an office-based?
In terms of the recommendation from the task force, I don't believe there's anything about the where part. I don't think there's anything about the where or the who.
So it could happen in any home. It could happen in the home, in the hospital.
And the recommendation, I think, is silent to that of an issue.
We have all of our usual Medicaid state plan issues about clinic services extending to home, which would be a potential limit here.
So what you're really recommending is the addition of the provider type. Reality, if there's a home care visit post-discharge with a newborn, lactation counseling should and could be occurring pre-discharge and at the home care visit. So I think the recommendation here is you're adding certified lactation counselor as an accepted provider type. Is that what the recommendation is?
As a provider type, and for their services.
Should be happening anyhow.
And they're for their services. So should be happening, could be happening. A lot of times ain't happening, but yes. So part of the struggle with this is support around this is sort of built into lots of different kinds of recommendations, professional recommendations from AP and ACOG and so on. It's sort of built into part of what's presumed to happen in a postpartum visit. Most folks would say that's way too late for some of the support. So it happens, it happens, I think, very sort of scattered in a sporadic fashion. Whether there's enough certified lactation counselors around who, again, this would make a difference or not, I don't know.
Well, presumably, it's Elizabeth. If they were reimbursed, there would be more counselors, right? Certified counselors.
It hasn't worked for certified asthma educators, but
yep. It's too hard. The exam's too hard.
That's necessarily true. Well, I know a lot of folks that aren't. RNs that can't provide service because of the DOE limitation or licensure. So So I think that's a, well, an important thing that needs to be addressed with this recommendation. I don't know if you need to have legislative changes or something in terms of scope of services that can be provided by whom, because we're cranking out all sorts of health educators out of SUNY, but they can't do anything because they do not meet DOE requirements. And I don't want to limit that for that reason.
There might be a number of services under consideration where we would be considering whether a new group of providers should provide the service. And in that instance, I suggest that in addition to having a level of evidence, we should have an indication of whether it's underprovided or underutilized. So, for example, if a particular service is being utilized to an extent that we think is appropriate, it may not make or it may not be a great imperative for us to extend reimbursement to a new group of people who would provide it. But if it's underprovided, in other words, let's say only 20% of people who should be getting lactation counselors are getting it, then that would be a much stronger argument in favor of extending it, particularly if it's really a USPSTF level B.
I think that's a great idea. I mean, in terms of the current columns we have, if we were to add a column on providers, I know we don't have any more room on this page, but that would be an important lens to look at almost literally every single benefit group.
On this one in particular, I also think it's important, as Dr. Foster had said, that we know, you know, at what point is it proven to be effective? Is it something that has to start in the hospital before the person leaves? Because, I mean, if they're out of the hospital for 2 days and the baby's not eating, it's pretty late. So that also changes, you know, how long person's doing it.
Right, but to the extent that, you know, as a state, we're doing numerous policies to push hospitals in the direction of helping with breastfeeding pre-discharge, and a number of successful initiatives, I think we may not need to worry that this specific service is delivered in the hospital. It's already being delivered under a number of other things. Or let me put it, it's not being billed for. They may not bother with that because it's bundled under something else, as long as it gets done. So I don't want to get too caught up in the weeds. If we're thinking about how best to make sure it's done right, that is important. I don't know what the answer is.
But price of service becomes really important in thinking about and maybe multiple places of service possibilities and in getting into the weeds of designing the benefit, what the cost implications would be, what the implementation issues are. So, right. So, I mean, if there is an expectation that some of this happens in a hospital versus outpatient in the home, it has a different set of baggage that it carries with it and implementation issues. I think that is certainly true. Whether that needs to be on here or whether it's under sort of implementation issues or not, I don't know.
Maybe part of the evidence of impact issues in terms of understanding how we're doing and how it's working out.
Do you need to have a hard stop as to how long the service is offered? Because if you do lactation discussion 6 months later, what difference did it make? So instead of looking at how quickly you start it, how quickly do you end it?
You know, when you add a provider type, does it impact the change in workflow? So even if you have these people able to do this, if it's not happening in a hospital, it's probably not going to happen in a hospital also. You know, if it's not happening at home, it's probably not going to happen at home. So what is it about that really set this up to be different? There's also this category of new provider type as a general category. And there's a lot of advocacy for adding provider types of all ilk. So if you're going to pick out one, sort of one-off to do, I think having criteria that's evidence-based by which we say this is one we're going to add provider type, but other provider types don't meet that set of criteria, if there's some way to generalize that, I think it would be helpful because we're getting a lot of advocacy for adding provider types all over
the place. Can I suggest a modification that is more the encouraging the need for lactation counseling and maybe rather than adding a home and provider type, recommending that since there are certain home visits that would be approved post-discharge, that lactation counseling be included in the home visit and that a lactation counselor can actually be the home visitor and take more home care agency and actually not creating a whole separate billing stream with a new provider type and really, really importance of lactation counseling, and the payers should carry it through their home care agency, and let home care agencies employ lactation counselors, and rather than an RN, you might need a lactation counselor going up. And actually, we can set a rate and pay it through a home care agency. That means I created a whole new structure and a whole new billing stream with a new type of provider.
If you talk about lactation consulting, it really needs to begin prenatally in terms of the preparation of the pregnant mom to be with how she gets started. And I'm in a group of 8 pediatricians who have 2 nurse practitioners. Both of our nurse practitioners are certified lactation consultants. And they do the prenatal visits for those things. They start the whole process then, and then they complete it after when the kids start coming into the office. As they go along, the difference is you can't bill for it. You can't be paid for it. We, good pediatricians that we are, feel pro bono is our way of life, as I was talking about Foster earlier. So we do it, and we don't get paid for it. There's so many things we do that we don't get paid for, that this is one of those things that actually has been shown to be, with level of evidence, valuable. So we could go through that whole breastfeeding discussion, which we won't, but it is of value. And it seems to me that it's one of those things that if we were to pay for it, and if it requires that they be certified, so be it. Because, in fact, in our case, we already recognize that in both of our health professionals too, but they can't go for it.
In this scenario, the service will be billed for under the supervisor.
Right, I understand. So that's what I'm saying. That would be fine. But I'm just saying there's a place for it prenatally. In the hospital, there are lactation consultants in Rochester. They are strong. And at Highland Hospital, they do an excellent job, and that's provided to the patients there. But there are lots of things that come about to it. But it really does need to begin earlier.
I couldn't agree more, because a lot of our patients actually have in mind when they're not going to breastfeed, you know, way before they go into the hospital. I think it's extremely important to start that discussion prenatally. And that, you know, oftentimes the obstetrician gynecologist won't have the time for a quote, or at least will at least make a mention about it. But if you can actually have someone who's targeted, who's going and actually speak to each patient individually, then they can pick it up again when they come into the hospital to deliver. And I'm talking about mostly on outpatient clinic settings.
So I think what I'm hearing is time limits. You know, both, you don't want someone who's not pregnant getting this. On the other hand, you don't want someone who's had a baby for 6 months starting this.
This is Elizabeth. As the mom of twins, you know, sometimes things materialize 6 months, and I'd hate to put, you know, a time. I'm not sure if that's wise to put a time limit. I mean, or I wouldn't want to presume that problems don't happen in 6 months when you're breastfeeding. I mean,
it may be a year, maybe it's some other, but some sort of time limit and some sort of number may make some sense in designing this benefit.
I would also suggest that that you speak to the WIC people, because WIC really keeps statistics on how many people initiate breastfeeding and when. And that could give you some ideas to how to build the boundaries around it.
Great.
I see some of the home visiting is further down on the list, but I think thinking about the links between this and certain home visiting services as well. I'm not sure what they are, but keep those in mind.
It's great we didn't have any discussion around the cost of it. No one seems to worry about it, so that's a good thing. But it does seem like it will result in significant clinical improvement, low cost, if at all, you know, rounding error, because we actually may save money even in the short term if we do this. So,
even long term for children.
Yeah, absolutely. We're not trying to quantify that.
He gave us a great cost analysis in the report. It's $60 to make it happen. It's $475 in reduction. We win.
Anything else we want to talk about with this? Any other general principles we're trying to abstract from this example?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand where we came out on the breast pump piece of this.
It's not part of this. The breast pump is not part of this particular proposal.
Does she have the updated?
You know, maybe Elizabeth, you're looking at a different version of this. We sent out an earlier version where there were several in different order and several combined. We tried to split them out a bit. We'll try to get you the new one sent to you right now.
I emailed Amanda for it, but I haven't heard back, so I am sort of
on
a gap here.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
podiatry for adult diabetics. Expand coverage of podiatry to all adult diabetics.
Makes good sense.
Everyone says yes.
Yeah. Medical friend.
So we actually met with the podiatrist yesterday, coincidentally, and, you know, it was interesting. They had a number of things that they had proposed, and they did not mention coverage of adult diabetics for Medicaid fee-for-service. And one of the things that they said was, this is a non-issue because the plans have been covering it.
Yeah. I've never heard of it. We have every diabetic that I've referred has always gotten serviced by the...
We don't pay for it outside. We don't pay for it outside of clinic settings or under fee for service for adults.
Like with the podiatrists that have the amputations and all the other groups that add on later on, if it's not addressed early on, I think that's it. But are we allowed to roll back? Because we get a lot of podiatry requests from people that are non-diabetics. Bunionectomies are a wonderful.
I think my understanding of, and Greg, you may know better, of the fee-for-service adult benefit is that podiatry is covered, but only at clinics. And I don't think there's any limitations about patient types or what procedures they can do. That is with the scope of practice. For
no, I'm talking about the benefit to coverage. You're talking about covering.
You're asking what will we cover?
Diabetes. The plans have generally been very generous, and we will do if individuals that do not have diabetes, if they've got vascular disease or other things like that, does it allow you to roll it back in a day of where we have big issues with cost and the like? I get requests for my cottage nails all the time. Things of that ilk. Okay, the toenail looks now yellow and whatever, we do something about it. Or we broke the instrument because it's so thick and the patient can't do it or the primary care will cut it. But I like to get a reality check here with you guys because yours was negative.
I'll defer to the MD.
Did you bring a picture by any chance?
No, it's a good point. I mean, I used to refer all the time to podiatry because I didn't have the time and necessarily the interest to cut those toenails myself. And will this change and incrementally or not so incrementally increase the cost of the state? It may.
My understanding of what you can and cannot do right now, the mantra is if it's less than the benefit in Medicaid fee-for-service, you can't do it. You can go beyond it. You can have your own utilization review criteria. But so my response to your question would be, if right now, and I don't know the answer, I presume the answer is yes, it is not a Medicaid fee-for-service adult could get that service in a clinic, then plans are not allowed to, on a wholesale basis, say it's not a covered benefit. You can decide, you can create circumstances under which
okay.
It's covered and so on. This specific proposal, again, the language under explanation, I think, is not completely clear or accurate. The dietary services for adult diabetics and fee-for-service are covered when within the context of a clinic visit. There's no specific podiatry billing for an adult. For kids, it's different. And I think the proposal initially was to say, well, that's a foolish policy particularly for diabetics, why don't we allow greater access to podiatrists for adults? But what I'm saying is that in reality, you know, when the podiatrist came in, I mean, this has some symbolic meaning. I don't know that it would have much of an impact either on costs or would not signal a wholesale change in podiatry services for diabetics, since without exception, that said Medicaid plans are, I mean, there was a society saying that they don't have an issue with it. So they have recommendations that go beyond that, which was to mandate that every diabetic have at least an annual foot examination from a podiatrist.
It would potentially have some co-insurance implications for dually eligibles if we covered in the fee-for-service program, since we're lining up our benefit package coverage and our dual payment. So it could definitely have an impact outside of the small number of fee-for-service patients. I mean, right now, it just is probably unfair, that you can get it if you're in a plan, you can't get it if you're an adult in a fee-for-service program.
But Joe brings up a very good point, which is that it's great to look at diabetic feet, take care of their nails, deal with the infections, that's all preventative. But sometimes going and do a bunionectomy or you're doing a hammer toe or something like that on a diabetic's foot, and man, you end up with an amputation because they didn't have great circulation. And the trickle down is that they, you know, get that done, then they get their foot revascularized because they were toddling along with it the way it was before, and now all of a sudden they can't do that. So you have to be clear as to the intended consequence, and then is there a opposite benefit restriction that we have to make to be able to say, yeah, it's great to do it, but there's a limitation of what you can do or should do because it could be a bad outcome to that you do it.
I'm not sure how to deal with that one.
Why don't we circle back on this one? Let's not say this is a slam dunk. Let's circle back into the next meeting. We can discuss this a little further after we talk amongst ourselves.
But is there general agreement, was I hearing general agreement that for the preventative diabetic services, we in general? Mm-hmm.
So even if we started with a list that we'll cover at least the following, would be acceptable, and then we can expand that list for changes.
Yeah, sure. And that was the reason it was framed this way, to open up the door this much.
Elective delivery, less than 39 weeks with no medical indication. We will eliminate coverage for it. Do not cover elective induction unless a documented medical indication is present.
Great. Here, here. Yeah, we discussed this last time, and we all agreed that it's a win-win. But as from an urban point of view, working in a very urban, very busy urban setting, this is easy to implement. So we should at least have some ability to at least look at this from a rural point of view, because with the decreased workforce, there may be some other issues that may not be apparent to me right now. But certainly, this is something that we already have implemented in our urban system in New York City. But we have a robust system.
I think in the rural setting, especially, you don't want to do this.
Right.
You know, clinically, it's not I'm playing golf or it's a weekend or whatever. There is just no reason to do this on a Friday afternoon so that it's done and I don't have to do it Sunday.
No, I'm not saying for elective reasons.
No. But the workforce, the complications, the downstream complications are even more urgent in a rural setting where you have fewer NICU beds. And so in that perspective, it's the safety aspect of it. It's even more important that they don't do it. Workforce issues. So there may be unintended consequences. I think this is one of the few areas, though, where the preponderance of evidence is just so great.
Yeah.
I think there are implementation issues in terms of being able to do this. Yeah, I think we may have talked about this last time, that there are, you know, a lot of this is going to be retrospective in nature. Right. But that's not to say that that's not, you know, unimportant or not a vehicle in which to change behavior. You also have, I think, what other states have seen, which is an increased documentation, is probably the first impact relative to medical indication. And, you know, I mean, I see this sort of as a phase one, phase two. Phase one is you document and there's medical indications. Phase two conversations are often how good are those medical indications, right? And I think there's still a lot of debate around some of them. I think it's probably too early to say here's the medical indications that we say is okay, these are the ones that are not. Do you agree? But it'll happen. So I don't know, you know, we didn't put the level of evidence in, I don't know how it fit in our hierarchy, but I think it's actually pretty good evidence as you described.
There's actually moderate evidence of harms in both this and in
moderate evidence of harms.
Harms. Okay. With a number needed to harm in the induction of labor for 39 weeks, the number needed to harm can be as low as 4. Wow. So it's
powerful. Do you know what that number is for the C-section?
No, I don't know what the number needed harm is, although the moderate strength of evidence shows longer hospital stays, higher risk of abnormal placenta and bleeding in subsequent pregnancies. And for the kiddies, it's increased NICU admissions.
Cool. Let's move to the C-section without medical indication. Any other thoughts, comments? Thanks. Okay. Reimbursement of nurses.
Just stop on that one for a second, because there are such huge administrative issues with this one. I don't think anybody has a concern about it in principle, but I think in terms of implementation, those administrative issues have to be figured out first.
Administrative issues on how you would not pay, or how would you know?
Exactly, and have you handle them? You know, the discussion about IPRO reviewing them, just figuring it all out. Mm-hmm.
Reimbursement of nurse family partnership services as a preventive service.
So I don't know how many folks around the table are familiar with this particular service. Pediatricians are nodding his head, as he should. This is intensive RN home visits to first-time high-risk moms. Starts in the first trimester. The evidence base for this was actually, the program was actually started homegrown in, you know, probably know Dr. Elmira, what's his name?
Olds.
Yes, thank you. There are, this program exists both in New York and nationally. There's a national organization, and the program exists in terms of coverage, at least partial coverage for Medicaid as well for the past year or so under the Targeted Case Management Program in two localities, in Monroe County and in New York City. It was an initiative, I guess, maybe 3 or 4 years ago to provide coverage as sort of a pilot program. So it was limited funding, limited geographically, limited in that targeted case management covers only a part of the cost of a nurse family partnership. Excuse me. So this proposal, as we've gotten it, is to move from sort of a limited geography, moving from targeted case management to, I think the proposal is full coverage of nurse family partnership. The evidence, there are folks in this room who can probably talk to the evidence better than I can. The evidence is pretty good for a number of different endpoints. There have been actuarial evaluations of nurse family partnership and other intensive home visiting programs which have shown return on investment. Those actuarial studies and return on investment have been more general and global returns to society, which includes savings in the criminal justice system and other areas, not as much specifically to Medicaid or to the insurer, but to the state in general. And the, I don't know, Kate, what else should I, what else? Loma or Bob, what else do you want to say about nurse family partnership?
I think you're doing a great job.
This looks fine.
Yeah.
Not to reiterate.
I guess there's a lot of evidence around the outcomes and kind of to Mark's point earlier, system-wide, you know, that don't all accrue in a health bucket. My question here about this is that you just mentioned that it's right now in two counties. Is the proposal right here that we're looking at to reimburse all nurse family partnership services statewide?
I think that's the proposal, yes.
And it's contingent upon a particular definition of risk. At least that's what I'm assuming. Is that a correct assumption?
The assumption is it would be all women who are in Medicaid would be considered high risk based on income. And but it's only for first-time mothers, and they have to sort of engage them in the first trimester.
So I live in a very rural spot that's medically underserved. I don't know about, I'm totally ignorant of this program, but it sounds very intriguing to me. But I don't know what the full scope of services, what are the services we're talking about, right? From our
standpoint. So can I call on folks in the audience to talk about the full scope of services? But there are services that are care coordination services and those and assistance with referral, and that's a lot of what's covered under Medicaid targeted case management payments. There's a whole other step. That's a minority of the services. A lot of the other services relate to education and support. And you want to
So how's this going to be a medical home?
Right. I'm sorry?
So how this sounds a lot like a medical home to me.
It takes place in the person's home.
There are visits by a nurse that take place in the person's home and with referrals to appropriate services and kind of, as Joanne said, kind of job. The goals are to stabilize and support the family.
Up to age two, correct?
Right.
So it's a long duration.
Reduce infant mortality and assure a good beginning for the child and for the mother. So it handholds the mom through the process up to age two, helps them get linked into community resources and services, and assure that the child is really off to a good start.
And I'm happy to send out some links.
It's not direct service. It's not direct nursing care or prenatal services as we would think of them. So it's an add-on.
Does anybody know if the supporting evidence used Medicaid as an inclusion criteria? I just asked because if the supporting evidence was stricter in terms of their definition of risk, it would make sense for us to at least consider using that stricter definition as inclusion criteria rather than assuming that anyone in Medicaid is a sufficient risk.
Good point.
I believe that low income was one of the risk groups for the initial study, but we can check and verify that.
In the 8 million emails we received, there were letters, and there was a nice description by Tamar Bauer, who was one of the national folks in this program, speaking to the points that were raised. So I think we've already, you can remove that, it's there. It was well written.
An operational issue that I'm kind of faced with is, okay, you've got the RN coming to the home and all that during the pregnancy and postpartum. But what I found out from my conversations with some of the folks there is that they're not allowed to. So you've got a woman that's got a gestational diabetes. That nurse is not going to get involved with any of the activities around that, which then means you have to send another nurse in from a home care agency, specifically a certified home health agency for rights and all that, not a licensed one like if one is doing the nurse family partnership program. Is there some way to meld it this? Because then you've got two different people coming in there with potentially two different stories and then coordination
issues. I would love to have it see if they could do it all. Is that a possibility to change, like regulatory change or whatever? And it also would decrease the cost, so you're not paying for two home visits like versus one. It would be more comprehensive. That's just my only ask. My understanding of the model, as everyone's making faces, I can't, I'm not that good at reading some people's faces, is that the model, as I understand it, does not have nurse providing direct service in the area that you
right.
just described. Is that, Joanne, is that?
Yeah, and it's my concern
right.
that if you get a nurse, if the RN, like the one program is coming in, she sees the woman, oh, you've got gestational diabetes, well, I'm sorry, but I can't do anything, you know, somebody else can do
it. I don't know if I'm not doing anything, but
so,
can't.
Well, no, but
right.
why don't we just do it? Since we have this opportunity, there are comments that have not been made. If you want to summarize anything else that hasn't been said, why don't we just give you the opportunity?
Thank you. The program model is very set, actually, and so I don't think New York can run a nurse family partnership program and change the model and get support, the full support of the nurse family partnership program. The program's been in existence for 30 years. If there are incidences of places where there's confusion between this nurse being able to not being able to provide service, that hasn't come to our attention because what we usually see is that nurse plays a key role in coordinating services and make sure that the woman who is pregnant is either able to get the services that the services can get to her. The nurse family partnership program has made an enormous commitment to staying with a woman through the entire pregnancy and then for 2 years afterwards. They don't drop women from their program. So their expectations
person now. It's been a program in existence for 30 years. Who's benefiting from the program right now in New York State?
In New York State, it's currently covered by state funding. We pay for some with TANF funding, with welfare reform funding. So there are state grants, whether they come from the feds or they're straight state. There is some Medicaid coverage through doing it on a case management basis, and there's private funding.
Right. So actually, I knew of a couple programs in New York City funded by the state, so I just needed to clarify this. So then the reality is the current state funding that's being used to manage a lot of the Medicaid population, can this be removed from budget neutrality and shift funds from one pocket to another pocket and add this type of benefit without having to feel the drive to cut something else to meet that budget neutrality? I know of a number of programs in New York City that a number of our members have actually benefited from, and it's coming, they were called grant funding, but the grant funding was really coming from the state. So it's really just left pocket, right pocket. Realizing the point, it belongs to the Medicaid.
It does. And I think that's the point of it, that we should. The precedent we're setting here is that when we know we're doing this somehow, let's figure out where it should be done and get it done right in Medicaid.
I guess my proposal would be, I don't think anybody's going to say this shouldn't be continued.
Right, but the money issues, right.
Not feel the need to cut something to meet the cost of the program.
And the other place where some of this work sits, not as nurse-family partnership, but through the community health worker program, that's also funded through New York State, and it's a grant fund that supports women at risk, not with nurses, with lower-level, like from a forest kind of workers, but it targets to do the same thing.
So these are great add-ons to our discussion point around this, and I think we should include it when we write up the proposal as part of what we've learned from doing this. Is let's try our best to quantify. You know, suddenly you're getting a federal match. You know, what are we getting by doing this as a state as a whole, not just looking through the Medicaid lens.
And this requires waivers, not normally.
Correct. Yes, it will require me, but we've been pretty good with that.
One picky point. Why do we limit it to first trimester for following him for 2 more years? That's the first picky point. That's the evidence base. And why are we using nurses if we're not letting them be nurses?
We are letting them be nurses. They do.
And then the third.
Okay.
You say they do. I trust you. And the third point is, this is sort of a policy thought process, is we've identified a high-risk population. We've put care management versus care medical care in two different buckets and sort of separated them a little bit. And can we use this as a good example of looking at other high-risk populations to put care management in place as opposed to just care delivery? So those
great
two,
idea.
Mm-hmm.
Great point.
This technically, I guess, looks like a health home for pregnant women.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But I take your point further, and I think we should identify those populations and figure out what evidence-based, because that's what we have here, approaches we have to help those patients outside of medical care.
As an OB-GYN provider, I like the idea that it kind of navigates patients who may have low literacy through a very complex health system. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why it works.
Well, I hear pretty much support throughout on this. We'll do a little more writing around it and understand some of the numbers and which pocket things are coming out of who benefits. But overwhelmingly, this is a supportive of this proposal. Let's move on to the next one. PCI. Do you want to talk about this?
Sure. I talked about this in the last meeting. Basically, the idea is that PCI is overused for many years now at both ends of the spectrum for patients with severe coronary artery disease where it could perhaps benefit more than bypass surgery, for patients with mild coronary artery disease where they could perhaps benefit more than medical therapies. In 2009, the American College of Cardiology, the American Heart Association, and four other societies developed some appropriateness criteria based on all the literature that was available at that point. Came up with these appropriateness criteria. The appropriateness criteria were applied nationally in a recent study in JAMA, that found significant percentages of inappropriate use and uncertain use. We've also applied this to the New York State data using the New York State cardiac registries that we have, and we found that the patients at the mild end, coronary artery disease, that the inappropriateness rate was 14%, the uncertain rate was 50%, only 36% were appropriate, and that furthermore, even before taking a look at that denominator, 28% of the patients could not even be rated because they didn't have enough information available to determine whether or not the procedure was appropriate. So if we were to apply those criteria to the New York State data, there's lots of room for savings and lots of room for denying inappropriate procedures that also can cause harm. The details here are a little bit sketchy and need to be refined a little bit. The particular subset of patients that we're talking about are the ones that have no acute coronary syndrome, meaning they don't, they haven't had a previous heart attack, they don't have unstable angina, and those are the patients for whom most of the inappropriate cases come from. So the idea would be to restrict the determination to that set of patients. Also, the numbers seem maybe a little bit even understated in terms of the number of patients this would apply to in terms of the dollar figure per patient, but I can go over that later. So, I mean, I think that this is probably an underestimate of the amount that we would say.
And we don't know, I don't know if duals are in for or not, but again,
I'm not counting.
I think you excluded duals from the event. Although the general rule of doing this is like doing home improvement, right? You should half the amount you think you're going to save and double the amount you think you're going to spend.
Yeah.
And you're like almost close.
Right. Well, I mean, I'd have to take a look at the percent that you applied in terms of what the savings would be, but it looks as if, for instance, that the cost figure is $1,500 or so per patient, it should be more than that.
Right.
Just
a couple of comments. I conceptually agree with you that there's a fair bit of unnecessary being done. And I think the real question is not whether to try and ratchet it down. I think we'll agree with that, or I hope we would. But how to do it in a simple enough and navigable enough way. And part of the issue with the ACC-AHA guidelines, I don't know how many of you have actually gone through them, they're very, very detailed. They use four different classes of recommendation. And there's an 05 set that was amended in 07 that was further amended in 11, but not completely. So you have to pull pieces out of each. And then for stable angina, there's actually an entirely different set of recommendations. So trying to put all that into some kind of an algorithm, I think, could be challenging. Perhaps one of the ways to do this is a very simple approach, which is if you don't have an obstructive lesion, you shouldn't have an angioplasty, period. And I think that would get to a lot of what you were suggesting as unnecessary procedures, but might be a more simplistic way of doing it. I'm not wedded to that, but I'm just saying that, you guys are probably going to have to figure out some simplistic set of criteria that's easy for the practitioners to understand, and hopefully they do, but also is usable for you.
A couple of things. One, what you're referring to is the guidelines, which have been revised 3 or 4 times, but in addition to the guidelines, there are some more definitive criteria, which are the appropriateness criteria that were issued just once in 2009. I'm referring to the appropriateness criteria. The appropriateness criteria rate the patients according to 4 or 5 different criteria. The number of deaths, the number of coronary artery disease, whether there was proximal left main artery disease, the level of angina, whether it was the patient's asymptomatic, level 1, level 2, level 3, whether there was maximal medical therapy or not, and the results of the stress test that the patient took. Most of the patients that fall out from here as being inappropriate are patients for whom the stress test results and the medical therapy determination kick them out, meaning that they had stress test results that were not highly positive, or they had stress test results that were not positive at all, and that they didn't have maximal medical therapy. But at any rate, those appropriateness criteria developed by these six societies do place patients into roughly 100 different cells that are intersections of those five criteria. And one can take a look at a table that was published in the paper that elucidated the criteria that just with that single page of the table, you can take a look at those cells, and the moment you identify these four or five different characteristics, you can immediately determine whether the patient is inappropriate, uncertain, or appropriate for the procedure. I think it's that information regarding that table could be disseminated easily to cardiologists, and they could have that. We have, for instance, done that with our registries to give patients, to give the cardiologists and surgeons information about what the expected mortality rate would be as a function of patients that have certain clinical characteristics. I think the same sort of thing could be done with the appropriateness criteria. So they could have this little card as a cheat sheet, just to, and it would just take a few seconds to really drill down to what to, prior to the procedure being performed as to whether or not it's appropriate.
You know, why I wanted to include this in this list of discussion items was this is an opportunity to really look at quality. This is pretty black and white. A third of elective, we're talking elective PCI, not urgent, one-third are indicated. Two-thirds, we don't know, or they're clearly not indicated. That's unacceptable. And at the cost of under $20 per patient in this registry, you know, that's what ultimately boils down to, is for a $20,000 procedure, it's $20 worth of collecting this information. We can certainly move the bar considerably into getting patients evidence-based care or withholding non-evidence. I think this is an important opportunity for us to say, this is quality, we're going to advance the state. It's going to be very complicated initially, possibly, to roll out. If you can make it, if you can make it simple enough,
right, or as we're talking about, the output arm of this, we already have established in the United States Prescriber Medicaid Prescriber Education Program, and we've done this before for pelivizumab and for other drugs. We've been able to outreach through the web and through other direct contacts with individual physicians and physician offices to disseminate the information you need to do that for that. And we can do that if people want us to do that. So that there is an arm to that type of outreach already exists.
Right. And I think that I find last time that, you know, you already have data by hospital where some are 40% off the mark and others are right on the mark. And so we've already got drilled down data that gives us behavioral patterns that we can actually spot, touch.
Right, right. Exactly. And that can even do more.
You know, that's
down
your big impact.
Elizabeth, and then Ed, Elizabeth?
Hi, I'm sorry. I've been contacted by a couple of members of the public. Unfortunately, I think when you guys got me on, you forgot to call into the members of the public. The other number, the listen-only number.
Okay, we'll see what we can do to rectify that. Thanks, Liz.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt, guys. I didn't know how to get in.
Thanks.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think another thing that could be done, and obviously one of the things here, and I'm sure that's one of the concerns that you're addressing, is, you know, we don't want people performing the procedures unknowingly, not knowing that they're inappropriate because it's too difficult to determine whether they're appropriate or not. I mean, I think one of the things that could be added along with this whole thrust of trying to reduce these inappropriate procedures is to try to provide a webinar or seminar to the cardiologists to help them understand precisely where these appropriateness criteria come from, how appropriateness can be determined in advance so that they're not unwittingly doing these things.
I'm completely with you. I agree with the commissioner. Nothing is more upsetting than seeing an angiogram and then finding out that somebody has a procedure, and there's just nothing there that, you know, that really should have been intervened on. And, you know, we've seen these, and none of us are happy about it. I'm just suggesting that we ought to think about the simplest way to do it, that's all.
Absolutely. I think that the laudable goal is to use Medicaid as a driver for improvements in quality in a meaningful way, in a short amount of time, on a complex and challenging condition. Now, this is heart surgery we're talking about. We are not talking about something simpler. And I think we can do it. It's about how we do it.
And as part of the heart health initiative crossed by the feds, why aren't there more general practitioners, internal medicine people using the proper medicines to use for disease to prevent the thing in the first place? Is another target population.
Absolutely.
That they can be going after.
That's right. Good. So, any other discussion or ideas or comments on this proposal?
I don't know if you talked about it when you left the room, but one of the things that I think that's important for the group to remember is that in your presentation, both previously and this time, we're leaving untouched, at least for now, this issue of uncertain benefit. We're leaving untouched this issue of the percentage that don't even have sufficient information to make a decision, right? So this is, in effect, I mean, that may be for a later date, but this is really kind of starting with what appears to be, from 20 paces, the easiest and clearest set of circumstances.
Yeah, I should add that, you know, the way the appropriateness criteria are written, it does say, well, there may be extenuating circumstances. So I guess one of the questions there is, how do you handle the extenuating circumstances? Do you allow people to ask for prior authorization to do these cases when the judge could be inappropriate? The problem with opening it up in that regard is that if there is no penalty for asking for prior authorization, people could ask for prior authorization for all of these inappropriate procedures and then use up an awful lot of resources trying to determine the prior authorization. So that's something that needs to be mulled over.
Okay. We can't just send them all to you.
I guess the one thing in the back of my mind, and I just want to lay it on the table for people to hear, is that, and I'm very familiar with the appropriateness criteria, and I understand that, but if you follow them pretty strictly in terms of the elements of information you need, what you sometimes see is a patient on a stress test without imaging, and the result will be equivalent, and then we'll go have a stress test with imaging, and then maybe the nuclear is an okay for somebody to do a stress echo. And by the time you sort of work your way up to a cap, you know, you have a lot of radiation exposure and a lot of very necessary testing. There are many situations, and, you know, I've seen these studies, I'm sure many of the clinicians in the room have seen these studies, where, you know, a couple of ER visits, you know, you just can't explain it away, and the more expeditious thing to do is just do a cap and be done with it, and then you have your answer, and eliminate subsequent hospitalization and so on. A situation like that would be one of those uncertainties, perhaps, in terms of those appropriateness criteria, because the non-invasive data is just not there. And whatever criteria we use, I think we're all going in the same direction. I just want to make sure we think about that and don't wind up adding to all the non-invasive stuff that really, I think, is very unnecessary.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is important to stress that, you know, when non-invasive stuff is needed, it's not needed for roughly 100 cells here that you're looking at. It's not needed for most of those cells. The only instances in which it's needed is that with regard to the other criteria, the patient all looks very healthy, but minimally sick. So it's those stress test, positive stress test results that get over the hurdle to then make it regarded as appropriate. So, you know, it's not just for everybody. I mean, if the patient has cerebrovascular disease, the patient has engine level 3, et cetera, you don't even need
to stress that. The other thing I wanted to bring up is the work we've been able to do to date on this has been possible through a specific line item in our budget, which will likely be eliminated. To the extent that something like this would be of value to Medicaid, does it make sense in this proposal to set a precedent that Medicaid should be charged with collecting the data, essentially paying for collecting of that data, about $1 million a year to pay for this initially at the low end, and up to $3 million for this much data.
Collecting which, I just want
to
make
to
sure.
To do the CCI registry.
Hmm.
Should Medicaid pay $3 million a year to then be able to save several hundred million a year? Hmm. And if so, should it be baked right into here?
It seems that would make sense until some point where it levels off
in the future.
Exactly. Well, sure, yeah.
And there, I mean, there seems to be a lot of potential commercial benefit and other benefits to this as well. And, you know, it's a driver for equality in the state, obviously. Is there a way to partner with other people in this?
I think that's been an active conversation for a long time, and I know I've been talking to others as well. I think in the short term, having this baked into a proposal here would allow this to actually work next year, whereas otherwise we may be at risk for doing it. And so baking in that a proportion of the savings up to a certain amount would feed back to this registry may make sense. Yeah. Yes.
Are there any other conditions or procedures that are being also looked at here in the same way? If you're going to do that, I think you might as well include any other potential registries that you would want to have to be able to do the same sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm more interested in the precedent that we set. Ed, are there other registries or something that would also yield cost savings down the road and quality improvements that are...
I mean, the registries are relatively limited. One of the problems is that, you know, it does take a lot of resources in order to get these data from the registries, and it also takes some will to get the data from the hospitals. And the thing about the cardiac registries that makes them doable, besides the procedures being so expensive, is the fact that the certificate of need, and so there are only roughly 50 hospitals that either do angioplasty and or surgery. And so the 50 hospitals, you have to keep track of and make sure you get their data in, make sure the data are clean. If you move it to something else, like Horizon Moderation or aortic aneurysm, so roughly 200 hospitals in the state would do those procedures. At the start of registry, you've got a ride herd of 200 hospitals and those hospitals that they don't send you the data. There's no certificate of need that you can hold over their head to get to make sure that they do send it. That's what makes it so much.
The only thing that comes to my mind is the Canadian study that I read about 5 years ago that looked at the intensity of urological procedures that you've done in a geographic area that's next to Ontario. On the other side of the border, New York, with the same population, the differences in biopsies and endoscopies and da-da-da-da-da for no excellent reason at all might be another area.
Just thinking out loud, we've talked in the state about how an outpatient hypertension registry like Rochester is doing makes a lot of sense for many number of reasons, from outpatient quality of care and, you know, setting a baseline, understanding this whole epidemic of silent MIs, which are not really silent, they're just not just labeled hypertensive. So those are the kinds of things. But I don't think that there's an urgency to do that in this meeting because next quarter we could do the question.
Okay, right. Inquiring
but as a precedent, I think it makes sense that Medicaid should be paying save itself money and improve quality simultaneously in areas where there's clear data needs which otherwise would not naturally be collected. And something like this could evolve over time where you have electronic health records deployed at a certain level that are HL7 compliant, that talk to each other, and we can get all that data. But for the next 3 to 5 years, there's a clear need for a few million dollars, which will save exponentially more. Let's try to bake it into this proposal and see where we go from there. And then
that's
what
we'll start. I didn't mean to throw a wet blanket on the whole idea, but it's a great idea. And I mean, one of the things that can be done also is to try to beef up the Spark state. We try to do some regards, for instance, for AMI, we have some now clinical data on the demand. So I think Spark enhanced database could also be used to explore different kinds of procedures and different kinds of medications.
I think most people have been in the game for a while recognize the fact that the statement that Parr Lilly was really quite visionary in establishing the cardiac registries. But the hospitals now are in a very peculiar situation. I think we've chatted about it, and I don't know if it even bears on this meeting. Most of the managed care entities are interested in benchmarking across the entire country, not just the state. And as conditions of participation, many of those CON procedural hospitals are being required to participate in either the ACC Angioplasty Registry or the STS Society for Thoracic Surgery Registry. And we find ourselves in the situation of participating, of course, in the state registries, but as a same time participating in other registries. We're literally doing duplicate data entry, and there really is very limited software that allows us to do single entry and have, you know, A go to one and B go to the other. And I guess the question is there some opportunity going forward, you know, to try and consolidate, because that would relieve, you know, significant cost burden and yet probably get us even better information.
Yeah, I can speak to that. I mean, what we're doing right now, we hope to have something within the next 2 or 3 months, is trying to align our registries almost exactly to the national registry.
The reason
why they're not aligned now is that our registries, one, our registries came first, and two, when there are differences are primarily because our cardiac advisory committee recommended different definitions in the national registry with an eye toward avoiding gaming problems. But I think we're prepared, given the onus on hospitals now to report to the national registry, we're prepared to try to equip as possible align the state and the national registry.
I just want to make one more point about medication, and that is that the requirements, the data that come out whether the patient's in hospital or on appropriate medications that's discharged is a requirement, and it's monitored by the organizations that monitor hospitals. And there was a study done at Albany College of Pharmacy that showed that there were 15 hospitals that were looked at, and all of them had between 92% to 98% compliance with converting enzyme inhibitors or ARBs, aspirin use, all the right drugs to be used when a patient was discharged. They had access to the pharmacy claims database, and those same patients were filling 37% of those prescriptions. And so there's a drastic need to have at point of care them actually taking the medication that they're supposed to be taking. And that's not factored into much of the stuff that we're talking about. Just to throw that out.
What I was going to say is just that we have huge opportunities now on the electronic health record side. You touched on it, but UPHN is being built out at this point in time. And as you build the state network, you know, getting this data will become easier as we move forward. The big key, though, is you have to build to the same point. So if you're building to the criteria, and they're wide criteria, we have to make sure we have very narrow criteria we build to, or else we get lots of data that doesn't mean anything across the board. And that's important.
I'll just go back to your earlier question about funding source. I mean, I guess from my perspective, it would seem to make sense, since this is a public good, so to speak, that it should be paid more out of an insurer assessment that we do other public health goods as opposed to strictly funded by Medicaid.
That's a good point. I mean, there are a lot of opportunities out there, but in terms of the short-term needs, I'm just thinking.
It's a small dollar amount. We have.
It is a small dollar. Data. Exactly. But, you know, like Sparks, for example.
Yeah.
That's something that's funded out of the hospital, out of their bottom line. There has to be a fundamental rethinking about the value of data and who's paying for what. As we come to a true all-payer database in the state, that's going to be invaluable. As we get the universal public health known, as we get this SHINE statewide health information network, New York, called the SHINE, established, there's going to be exponential ability for other folks to use it. And I don't think we're even one step on that journey of figuring out who pays for what. But we should keep that in mind. I agree.
Let's move on to the last item before we get to additional services. Thank you. Growth hormone therapy for idiopathic short stature. Walter, you want to talk about this?
No. I'm hoping some folks from the health plan, maybe Joe or Arnie left. I think it came from Joe and from through Hudson Health Plan, had actually a fair amount of information in the background about. Right. I think this was initial. This is about restrictions related to specifically use for idiopathic short stature versus folks that have clear documented growth hormone deficiency.
Right.
And I would say that, you know, the history on this, at least that I've been aware of, is that this has been frequently, and these are the kind of cases that go to external review. They've been hotly contested. the last that I looked at sort of where the external review determinations landed, it was sort of a, you know, frequently a 50-50 sort of thing. That is 50% of the time the plans won, 50% of the time, you know, the provider and the person who appealed won. So there is real, you know, I think, split clinical opinion about some of the specifics of these cases. And so, you know, there are challenges in terms of bright lines. I don't know, Bob, if you have experience or thoughts about specifically about short stature and growth hormone and
well,
so on. It's obviously
being one of them.
I wasn't picking on you.
I have two patients who are in this category.
So the expense is very high for growth hormone. You know, there's an overall no number. I can't remember what the specific costs are per dosing, but it's not insubstantial. So I think that this one was about creating some restrictions around its use.
Yeah, and there was pretty strong recommendations from CDRP to stick to the data. I mean, that really was a
I have to agree.
As another fellow short person, I would agree that you know, I don't like looking up at all these people.
You want people in the second percentile shooting up above you.
Exactly. I want to see you right in the middle. But we have an opportunity for a large savings here that could really fund a lot of evidence-based stuff that we want to do. You know, you're looking at $15 million first year alone, and that's an estimate, which means it's an underestimate.
Can I'm not a medical person, and I'm reading the explanation, and I don't really understand. Just saying that it doesn't work, or either it has risks, or...
No, if you're going to be 5'5",
right.
When you grow up, am I someone who should have gotten these hormone shots when I was younger and ended up at 5'10"? And or taller, and it's a judgment call.
Okay.
It's that kind of a gray zone where you know there's no you're not going to be like 4 foot. This is for the inner.
Okay.
Certain conditions like where it's barely indicated, but it's more or less like I want my kids to be tall.
That's all it is.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I understand that, but the thing is, there's no underlying medical issue that you're really dealing with.
All of us are vertically challenged, don't think it's necessary.
On my way here, like going through the parking garage, I had to go through some scaffolding, and I almost hit my head two or three times. I wish I was shorter. You know?
Dave, do you know what the current CDRP criteria are that we would recommend?
Not off the top of my head.
Okay.
I distinctly remember a very strong OHSU way down in the University of Buffalo way down in the consensus against pursuing allowance of the drug to be used for non-indicated terms.
Well, it's been a while, so I'm kind of fuzzy. It's but there. We require PA now, right? And we
now you're.
So I think part of what has to happen here, and Ron, I don't know if you recall this, but we have to, in terms of the savings opportunity here, we have to cross what we're doing now to anything that would be coming that would potentially be new. So I think we would at least owe the committee of what we're doing through CRP and what and is there an opportunity there in terms of copying that policy or expanding that policy as we move toward the carve-in here or through the carve-in here. So I think we could bring that
black and white. It's got to be pulled and looked at, and that's just kind of set.
Okay, because that claim volume that we're looking at now may be post the current PA that we're doing. But
it probably is because we met on this about 18 months ago.
It was a while ago.
Yeah.
So we'll owe that back to the committee. Is there something that could be strengthened, or is this one maybe mostly implemented?
Right.
Cool. Yeah. Mm. For $15 million worth of impact.
So we agree that we should limit this benefit according to the guidance that's given us in detail out.
Yeah.
And this is another important area that we should go forward, continue to review on a case-by-case basis such opportunities. I think at this point, you know, we have a long list of things that people submitted, and it goes on for pages and pages, 14 pages, as you can see. In terms of where, as a department, we want to touch base on different aspects of what this committee will work on, we've covered that list of kind of precedent-setting opportunities. I would argue that at this point might be a good point to break for the day, for us to digest some of this, for us to come back with full proposals around each of these that are detailed in a format that will ultimately go to MRT and get that to you for your review and thought prior to our next meeting. I know we're going to be asked to do some other things in our next meeting around proposals. For example, we're going to have to look at the health disparity impact on whether these things help make that close the gap, neutral, or make the, that gap bigger. And so there's going to be enough to be done around these proposals themselves that I would argue we should consider moving on and not consider any more below the bar. If upon review of all of those that are below the bar in the next few weeks, we get from you an email or two or a large hankering for doing a specific one, we can always open it up again to another proposal or two. Yes.
Well, there was one here that it has a rating of A that's below the bar. It's up from the task force, and then it was reimbursed in the Senate.
I think the rating A is for smoking cessation counseling, not specifically about dentists and pharmacists.
Oh,
is that
what that was?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. All right. I just thought that was.
So it's a question of whether or not, you know, and again, it's just
scope of practice.
Scope of practice and scope of benefits.
No, I just thought we had agreed we were going to put everything up there.
Can I ask if we can talk about a way that, because it seems to me we've come up with a few scope of practice like kind of issues, and I know there's a whole other work group that's dealing with scope of practice, so is there or can we come up with some kind of formalized way to, because I think we identify it and it shouldn't be that that's the end of the discussion.
Oh, no, I think that that's the point, is when they come up, that's all they're working on.
Right.
And when they come back with their in-depth thinking about scope of practice, we can apply that lens to all of our proposals as well. And that's what that mothership that he likes to call mothership will do, is look at all the proposals through all the lenses, and then we'll ultimately go through that exercise we did with MRT Phase 1 with that modified Delphi ranking and rating of each proposal.
Okay. Well, and I was thinking of kind of backing that up and sort of saying, what are the, if we could identify the ones where we've identified scope of practice and push those over to them to say, here's several scope of practice issues that we've come across. Can you consider these?
We certainly can. I actually think there aren't that many, not in the ones we discussed so far. So the lactation consultants may be one. I'm not sure. This one is not a scope of practice issue. This is just about who's eligible to deliver benefit and get paid. So for that one, I would say that to the degree that they're going to get that far into the weeds, or they can chew on it. They also have a, I mean, you were there, right? So it's a short, weren't you there?
No.
Okay, I'm hallucinating. So it's a short time frame in terms of their deliverables, and they've got the whole scope of practice and workforce issues on their plate. But I don't think that, I mean, I think we should feel free to send things in their direction. We've certainly gotten things from other groups as well. But I think happily most of what we've discussed so far does not involve big time
scope
of practice issues, as I see it so far. Again, some of these other ones maybe do, but not the ones we've talked about.
I would suggest we just take the dentist and pharmacist
and
put it into that bucket that we're working with, only because it is an underutilized service benefit right now, so that looking at it and maybe incorporating the dentist and the pharmacist with the smoking cessation benefit may help.
The requirement will have to be all pharmacists who are going to recommend people to stop smoking should not sell cigarettes at the drugstores. Well, you know, it's the big box stores that want to sell them.
You know, I would absolutely put that in.
I mean, that would be
absolutely.
I think that would be a great idea.
Yeah. I love it.
The
guys below the bar
that I would like to put forth for consideration is the diabetes prevention project. Because that's because also of the public health importance of diabetes and obesity.
So Scott, part of the reason we put it below the bar is we actually, there are, as you know, there's a number of programs going on right now, and this program is a piece of this of a grant that we just got from CMS to explore the use of incentives to engage Medicaid members in various kinds of health promotion behaviors, and the Y program is one of those specific ones in which, you know, there's we're working with the University of Pennsylvania and Kevin Volk around trying to look at the impact of that program, the impact of incentives, and so on. So that was one of the reasons why we put it under the line. We wanted, this is one area where we do have permission to, if you will, do a pilot. Think about this. And some of that, some of the program itself is being paid for, and then we can provide some incentives on top of that and see what we can, what we can say.
In terms of the pharmacy proposal, I suggest we'll take it back. We'll incorporate the hard stop on them actually selling tobacco.
I love it.
And then revisit it by email. But there's a general consensus that we want to include that in the scope of our recommendations for this work group. Fair enough. Okay. Any other below the bars that we want to look at urgently?
So when we come back, and let us know there are no others, but when you come back, will you present some money impact as well?
Now that we've focused it.
Yeah, we'll get out the money dartboard.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I'm an administrator. I'm not a business.
So
I appreciate the money.
2 seconds on some follow-up. Obviously, the finish the wordsmithing of the document, thankfully, it's not very much, but we'll pass around some of the suggestions and some of the language that we talked about, both for process and for principles. The second is to fill in these blanks, including the cost parts, and think about that provider issue.
Perhaps we can just put it in the format that we're going to have to submit it. You know, that longer format.
That may make sense.
On this, just give the final write-ups.
Yeah,
of all 11 or 12 proposals.
And we may reach out to some friends like Mark and others to fill out the evidence, have Ed correct us if we've, you know, been under precise on the proposal descriptions. We may, you know, send some of those around just to help us with the stuff that's in your guys' head. And then we could get the package back to everybody for general feedback between meetings.
One comment that I promise is my last. Above the bar right now, we have medical services. But since a large portion of Medicaid, a decent portion of Medicaid expenditure is on non-medical services, we might want to have at least one non-medical service above the bar. And the possible candidate for that could be non-emergent transportation. I think we have a transportation working group, don't we?
We
have a contract.
We've got a whole statewide plan for doing transportation management right now, which has got a whole bunch of different moving component parts.
Maybe there's something else there.
Move something up that's spending outside of the straight line medical benefit.
Right. Good point.
So then the next meeting is really to go over these proposals with more detail and be clear that folks are, you know what it is that, if you will, they're voting for or saying that they approve of in terms of recommendation. To hopefully the language on the two documents will be finalized through email before that time. And that's really, that's it in terms of the agenda. Is there anything else about the report? I guess there could be other recommendations to MRT.
If they're asking us to then look through the disparities lens, that may be something new. I just got an email now during the meeting. That committee has asked us to look at every proposal we do through that lens. I haven't gone through all of what they're asking us to do. But that may be something we can spend a little time on.
Right.
That's also, I think, a line on our one pager, so we can use that as the way to.
And
do
is
it.
There a way to look at that? Is it
I'm sure they define it.
And when is our next meeting?
The 19th.
The 19th.
It's here, I believe, again.
This is a detail point, but I just something that's below the line is the is it tributyline for a preterm waiver. I just wanted to mention that dollar amount includes asthma inhalers, so it's way overstated. So we'll have a more precise number on that one. I just wanted to announce that so everybody can go, wow, look at how much we're getting a preterm waiver.
Well, thank you all for participating. I appreciate your patience on the phone, Elizabeth.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll see you in person next time in 2 weeks. And until then, stay.
Thanks very much. Buddy. Good meeting. Thanks for the input.
Let's turn the
thought it might be. The system has detected that a minimum number of lines are connected to this conference. Do you want to continue your meeting? Press 1 to confirm. If there is no response, the conference will end. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.